One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are talking about the end of the Champions League group stage as Manchester United and Newcastle United go out not with a bang but a whimper. As Manchester City and Arsenal cruise through, we'll be asking, can an English team reach the final? And we'll also assess the other contenders to win the trophy. Joining me, Tom Clark. Today we have Chief Correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, our resident former footballer turned pundit, Gregor Robertson, and as it's Christmas, we've got a second special guest in just 1 week. He played more than 200 times for Wimbledon's crazy gang before going on to manage and coach at 11 clubs, including Crystal Palace, Reading and West Ham. Wally Downes is our special guest on today's show. Wally, welcome to the Game Podcast.
Thanks for having me, fellas. Yeah. You left out Barcelona and Real Madrid, didn't you?
I did. Well, I wanted to leave that for you to bring up, you know, your kind of your special secret career in Spain's La Liga. We can come on to that and your European football expertise in when we discuss the Champions League, which we're going to dive into right now. Should we start with Newcastle, I think, of the two Uniteds?
Yes.
Beaten 2-1 by AC Milan to finish bottom of their group. And Martin, you were saying before we came on air, I'm not even going to sugarcoat it, you're not particularly impressed by this Newcastle.
Well, no, it's nothing. I'm impressed with Newcastle, as everyone knows, but I'm not particularly impressed with the way no one loses anymore. I don't know if you've noticed this. I don't know if it's we've got into this touchy feely type thing where we're scared to hurt anyone's feelings, but it Australia retained the Ashes, and it was like this great big triumph. And if you look at the sports personality of the year, Mary Earp, 7-1 on favourite, it's a year when England didn't win the World Cup and we didn't qualify as Team GB for the Olympics. And looking at Newcastle, everyone is saying, oh, this proves, that they're ready for European football. And I get it was a really hard group, much harder than anyone else's. Newcastle finishing bottom of that group is totally different to Manchester United finishing bottom of their group. However, they're winning 1-0 at home against AC Milan. PSG didn't do their job last night. If PSG had won, Newcastle lay out the tournament. But PSG didn't win. They drew. So Newcastle had to hang on to a 1-0 lead at home to AC Milan, who are the third best team at the moment in an Italian league that no one particularly talks up anymore. And they got beat 2-1. So I would be very disappointed if I was a Newcastle fan. And I realise where they were 2 or 3 years ago. Absolutely, I realise where they were 2 or 3 years ago. And I realise that anything involving the Champions League is beyond their wildest imaginations. But it's a little bit like that, the plucky lower league team being 1-0 up at Anfield with 5 minutes to go and getting beat 2-1 in the cup or whatever. There comes a point where you think, all we need to do is hang on here for 5 minutes. All we need to do, and all they needed to do was hang on to that 1-0 at home, and they've ended up getting beat 2-1. And I'd be really disappointed if I was a Newcastle fan, and I'd be really disappointed if I was Eddie Howe, because if PSG had won, well, then that's fair enough. There's nothing you could do about that. It was out of your hands in that respect. But PSG didn't win, so if Newcastle hold on to a 1-0 lead, they're in the last 16.
Yeah,
and I'd be disappointed with that.
Wally, what do you make of Martin's assessment there?
Well, he's right, because if he says that AC Milan aren't really revered as much as they was, but they have a European Championship experience.
Yeah.
They know what to do in a one. If they were 1-0 up against Newcastle don't come back and win 2-1. Hmm. So Newcastle is saying, have moved on from where they were 2 or 3 years ago, but they've got to look at this as a learning thing. You know, Eddie's been in this sort of situation before, not European, but where he would have to see out a game 1-0. Perhaps he didn't do enough to see the game out there. I mean, whether it was the excitement of the crowd and getting caught up in it and wanting to play the same game, I don't know. But I didn't see the game, but I don't know what their formation finished up, but mine would have been something like 4-6-0, you know, and killed that game off.
But it definitely wasn't like that, was it? It was a bit end-to-end and a bit mad, really.
It all got too loose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, AC Milan must have been thinking, we got a chance here if they're playing like that, you know. And once they get a sniff there, then, you know, the balance changes completely.
What have you made of Newcastle generally? Because obviously, Martin, you're making the point of, we know where they were a couple of years ago, and in that respect, it's a brilliant achievement. But also, you've got to say, we know where they were 2 months ago, and we were on this podcast saying, they've got 4 points from 2 games.
Yeah.
Here we go, this is a chance. Wally, what do you make of them this season in the Champions League? How will they reflect overall, do you think?
Well, I think what they've had is an owner bounce. You know, you talk about a manager's bounce. When the new owners came in, everyone's jumped on it because they've had such a fallow period of time.
Yeah.
Eddie's done his own work while he's not in management and come in and put in place how he wants to manage. And everything took off for a year. Now, I think the last two months, they've sort of struggled a little bit with injuries and the bounce has finished a little bit. Now, if he can go again in January and relight the fires again, then that'll be it. Because a lot of this, a lot of Newcastle's success is based on what their fans want from them, what the expectation is now, and the players having to deliver over and above every game. Because, you know, they haven't got real quality right the way through the side, but what they have is, like Martin's talking about, to a lower league mentality. They've got a sort of underdoggy attitude to the way things were. You know, people didn't really want them to succeed straight away when they got the money, and there was all questions asked about that, but they gave it a right go, and now it's levelled out and they've got to, you know, they've got to go again, really.
Yeah, I'll come back to that point about potentially going again in the transfer window. Gregor, what would you say your assessment of this kind of, not just this performance, but now overall with the group stage, with Bowen out ending up bottom of that group?
I think there's a lot to feel regretful about after that, after the first two games, after hammering PSG at home. And particularly the Dortmund game at home, that was a real disappointment. And obviously losing back-to-back. You can come back to the PSG game away and, you know, they were unfortunate, of course, with the Livermento handball. And then you do come back to this one game, though. It was all in this one game. And Martin's right. I think there's a lot to feel regretful about in this one game itself as well, because the game became open just as they became looked more exhausted than they have at any point in the season as well.
Totally.
So, like, they had to bring off Kieran Trippier. Livermento came over to the other side, and that's when Leal started to do something in the game, because he looked knackered. Livermento was someone we were saying a few weeks back, like, he was getting the odd game in the in the Carabao Cup and whatnot. I think he's a player of potential. Now they're relying on him.
Yeah.
Like, he's having to play week after week. He looked knackered.
Was he injured, Trippier?
I think so. They said afterwards that he kind of walked past really gingerly past the pundits after, like, on the side of the pitch.
Coming off with gingerly was a thing when I was playing.
I don't know what the injury was, but I think he's got an unnamed injury. That's what even Martin Hardy wrote in his report today.
An unnamed gingery.
gingery, yeah. So yeah, because obviously you wouldn't think, like, why would they take off Trippier?
Exactly. Even if he's injured, you can leave him on and just have him block a hole, bring somebody else.
You did watch, look at the subs and think they were strange. You put on Dan Burn and took off Anthony Gordon and put on Isak. And you're thinking, that's why are you doing that unless you have to? So I think he must have had to. But they did. It just,
there's no way they need to play with two strikers when they're 1-0 up with 15 minutes to go, no chance.
So is that naivety on Eddie Howe's part, do you think, Wally? Or,
well, I wouldn't say naive, because he's managed a lot of games. You know, he would have been in that scenario stacks of times, and whether it's his policy, I mean, we always had a policy at Bury when I was there and we won the league, as soon as we went 1-0 up, could have been in the 15th minute, just withdraw. We played 4-4-2, but we withdraw one, go 4-4-1-1,
yeah,
you know, just to block it up a little bit. And if in that situation last night, it seems a daft thing to have two men up front against AC Milan.
Yeah. So going back to your point about going again in the transfer window, and you're obviously talking there about Kieran Trippier, do you think he maybe needs to sign some more experienced players, some more high-level players in terms of these occasions where, like Kieran Trippier, he'll have been there before and he knows maybe in those little moments when to put the foot on the ball, when to boot it out, when to take a foul, etc.?
Well, I think it's the quality of player. You know, Eddie's shown that he can put a good side together. He's shown that he can get them playing for him. The fans are on board with it. Now they need to improve the quality. You know, they can't keep buying, with all due respect, like Joe Linton's been great, but he's a very energetic guy. He's up and down, and they need some more quality than they have if they want to attempt the top four on a regular basis.
Yeah,
because they're playing on energy and legs and enthusiasm and the crowd behind them, and that can only take you so far. Yeah. At the highest level.
Martin, where do you think they go now then? Not just whether in the transfer window, but this season generally. Obviously had Sandro Tonali missing for a long time now. Other injuries and problems and things. They've had the Champions League to contend with. That means that in the league, they're a little bit maybe behind where they would like to be. How do they approach the rest of the season?
Well, I think, they're the team from outside of the top four when people are looking at Aston Villa and... Newcastle are possibly the team outside the top four that you can most see breaking into it, but it needs players to stay fit, for starters, the core, and they probably do need to go again in January. But again, it's how much they're allowed to go again. One of the reports that I read this morning said all the money in Saudi Arabia couldn't get Newcastle into the last 16. You think, well, no, it's not all the money in Saudi Arabia. It's the amount of money that they're allowed to spend that they've got at their disposal, because there's a lot of limitations and they don't want to end up where Manchester City are, facing a lot of charges and all of this. So they're trying to play by those rules. And... so it's not quite as easy as it looks. And one of the positions, you know, the Tonali position, it's a very, very careful balance they've got to strike, because they've bought Tonali and he will be available for the most part of next season. I think he misses the first month, doesn't he? You know, so you can't just buy another Tonali in that position, because then you've given yourself a big problem next year, because you can't keep them both happy and you've got Grimashi in that position And so it's very difficult. It's going to need a lot of skill. Fortunately, they've got Dan Ashworth as their head of recruitment. And Dan has done a very good job at everywhere he's been. And you'd think would have a list of suitable targets. But they look a little bit short.
The talisman at the moment's Wilson up front, isn't it? And he barely plays, or he comes back and he misses again. So that's a typical position that they've got to fill for sure.
Mm.
Gregor, are you agreeing going forward?
Yeah, look, it's a balancing act going forward. Like one thing again, like their revenues will increase, and that allows them to spend more. And it's the kind of a bigger picture, which also means not qualifying is a blow in that regard too.
Absolutely.
I think it was pointed out in maybe Charlotte's or Paul Hurst's piece as well. The same about Manchester United. They always budget to reach at least the quarterfinals, and there's something like a £30 million shortfall now. So that affects what you can spend.
Which is
Newcastle are maxed out, though, aren't they? Even they can't sell any more shirts, can they? They can't.
Yeah, well, that is also a problem. One of the problems that Newcastle have got, and it's strange, and this is why Saudi Arabia, might be a different market for them. But one of the problems that Newcastle have got is they're a huge team in Newcastle. That's a big problem for them at the start, because what they are, in many ways, we all regard Newcastle as a huge team. But beyond these shores, you're looking at a club without a great European pedigree, without this great global renown and everything. They're very, very comparable to a team like Schalke in Germany. That everyone in Germany knows how big Schalke are. They've got a 70,000 capacity stadium in Gelsenkirchen, for God's sake. If you've ever been to Gelsenkirchen, it's a very, very small place. To have a 70,000 capacity stadium. And it's an old mining, the film that they used to show before Schalke played showed fellas coming straight out of coal mine, straight into the stadium. And it's this massive, massive club. But if you were to ask people in this country, the biggest teams in Germany, they'd say Munich and Dortmund. And then if you ask another generation, they'd start talking about Hamburg, who I don't even think are in the top division anymore, because you remember sort of European occasions and everything, and Schalke haven't had that many of them. And Newcastle are a similar sort of club. We know how big Newcastle are because we've grown up with Newcastle and 50,000 crowds when they were doing no good. But they haven't got that same earning potential at the moment as a lot of their contemporaries, because they haven't got that global market. That's why Saudi Arabia could be quite important for them, if they could turn Saudi Arabia into a nation of Newcastle mm-hmm. fans. But Manchester United have got there first as well.
If you see Newcastle on a Friday night, everyone's got a Newcastle shirt on. If you drive outside of Newcastle 10 miles, you never see one.
Mm. No.
You're abroad, you might see Liverpool, Man City shirts, but you never see Newcastle.
Martin Hardy kind of struck on that point in his piece this morning as well, about they've just released a survey to their season ticket holders, I think, about improvements to St James's Park, and talking about a sushi bar and like vegan options and stuff. And they're like, no, this is the sort of the world that they're entering into.
Yeah.
He needs the growth, kind of expansion, and there's still something about Newcastle, they think.
Well, Man City have
just a one-club city.
Man City had a very similar problem. Man City were trying to, these executive seats, they're right in front of the press box at Manchester City, and, they've got these great big executive seats, and I can't remember what it's called, Century Club or something like that, anyway. But actually, it's not that kind of club. And all the Manchester City fans that were sort of displaced from that area have got the raving hump about it, because they don't see it's that kind of club. And, of course, when you're selling those executive seats, they're sold to the business class, say. So they've got their mates in, who might support the other team. They're entertaining a client or whatever. And I've sat there and seen murders in the executive, because someone's jumping up when Liverpool have scored or whatever, because he's there as a guest of a Man City fan who's got four of these seats. Two of them go up, they're Liverpool fans. The Man City fans sort of in the block next door want to strangle them or whatever. It's not that kind of club.
Much less like the London clubs where that's sort of, it's not a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Manchester United as well, where it's quite common or whatever. There's certain clubs, the difference between Liverpool and Everton is very much like that,
Having said all that, they were ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
Massively ahead of schedule.
And they were kind of, it was nip and tuck. They can count themselves unfortunate at certain moments in certain games, but they will have some regret, I think.
Yeah, well, one team where you could say it probably wasn't nip and tuck is Manchester United, where we kind of saw this coming. Wally, they're a team that we've talked about endlessly on this podcast, and Martin and Gregor have passed many, many judgments and many views. So I'm going to come to you, and I want to know whether you think this is just something that's so, so corrosive off the pitch at the club that any manager couldn't fix it, or whether there is some blame that has to be laid at Erik ten Hag's feet.
I don't think Ten Hag can be blamed. He's not bought the best, if you look at the amount of money he's spent, but he's in a terrible position there. I think we're talking earlier, it's a cyclical thing. Man United are in trouble for 15 years now, haven't won too much, haven't got the championship, but they've got to suck it up. They've tried everything to compete with Man City's, and to a certain degree Arsenal and Liverpool, but it's not that sort of a club. We was talking the other day, it's built on Alex Ferguson being a down-to-earth socialist guy, a worker, and getting good players in to work for him. And now, since Fergie's gone, they've gone for a series of superstar managers who have bought superstar players at the wrong time. I think these players have come in, and because they're behind Man City and Liverpool to a certain degree, they look at it and think, "Well, we're not going to beat them." Mm. And I think that's the attitude through the club now. I think they've half turned it in, because they can't be the top two. They're not putting the effort in to really make themselves third or fourth, and I think that's why it's slipping away from them.
So it's the delusions of grandeur almost in terms of
that's what they have now. But that's all gone because that ended with Fergie.
Yeah.
And, I certainly think they need a sea change. What's wrong with going out and buying the three best players in the championship, three people unknown, and giving that a go? Because they keep buying these big players. Mm. And there's no industry there. There's no cohesiveness. There's no common purpose, really, I don't think.
So you talk about workers and under Alex Ferguson and that kind of work rate and effort and, all those kind of old-fashioned...
If you look, he bought Steve Bruce, didn't he, from Norwich. It's difficult for Ten Hag. Now, if Ten Hag, I don't know enough about him, but he's had an easy job at Ajax. Winning at Ajax isn't that difficult, apart from the fact that they're doing no good this year. But for the last 20 years, it's been a relatively simple job. If they want to tough it out and keep him, and he changes and sort of delves into buying some younger, hungrier players, then Man United can come again. But I don't think they can come again with the current policy that they have, because they're buying players that Man City can't get or Liverpool don't want. And you've got to be a top player to play for Man United. And some of these players aren't top players, but they're playing top money for them and expecting top performances out of them, and they're just not getting them. And these players can afford to just, for want of a better word, toss it off, which I think they are doing.
Yeah. Martin, how would you react to some of that analysis about the playing staff that Erik ten Hag has got to work with? Would you agree with Wally's assessment about maybe looking to drop down in terms of prestige and quality to get a better, more effort?
Well, Wally and I were talking before this, and so when was the last time they went into the Championship and identified someone and went, right, this is a good player? And I was thinking, I'm prepared to be corrected on this, Daniel James.
Probably,
So, now, he didn't get the chances that Anthony has had.
No.
Now,
he played quite a bit under Solskjaer, but in bits and fits
and
stuff.
But, you know, now you look at Anthony is... Anthony starts week in, week out.
Has he been there 9 years, Mark?
No, that's Martial. That's Martial. Martial's been there 9 years. Anthony hasn't got a goal since last April and hasn't got an assist since last May, which is some going for a winger playing in a, you know, a very advanced position for Manchester United, that you haven't managed to create or score a goal since last season. And you look at that and think, but he's got chance after chance after chance. Daniel James, I don't think, did get chance after chance. And they did used to do that. You think Lee Sharp came from, I want to say, Torquay United. You know, there was...
Palace to Middlesbrough.
Yeah, absolutely. And that United were built on a sort of a work ethic that doesn't seem to be there. I mean, the other night, the most disappointing thing with it the other night, really, was that... they've got to win the game. That's the bottom line requirement. To make anything happen at all, they've got to win the game. And they created one chance. Now, you can go back to Teddy Sheringham talking about that Alex Ferguson team and most famously the 3-0 down, 5-3 up match against Tottenham. And he said the most exciting sight in football, and I quote this all the time, most exciting sight in football is Manchester United chasing a game. Well, actually, against Bayern Munich, they're chasing a game from the minute it kicks off, because they've got to win. And they create one chance against Bayern Munich. Now, the best Manchester United teams would have been going like madmen to get a goal in that match. It wouldn't have finished Manchester United nil.
To come back to my question to Wally then, is that Erik ten Hag's fault, or is that the players that he's got?
Well, Erik ten Hag has to bear some responsibility for the players that he's bought. But there has been... as Wally said, it's one manager after the other following a very similar sort of policy, and you end up with this mishmash of a team.
Look at this players he put on. Johnny Evans.
Yeah.
He's 36, and I think probably would have thought his Champions League days were behind him not long ago. Manu, who could be a good player, young lad.
Yeah.
Wan-Bissaka, just flatter to deceive. Pelestri and Hannibal. So
I didn't see the game. He brought those on.
That was his subs. Are they subs for Manchester United?
Who got on? All of those got on.
They all got on. Yeah, that was the five.
Johnny subs. Evans and Wan-Bissaka came on. Yeah. Chasing
Johnny
the
Evans.
Game.
Well, Harry Maguire was injured. Harry Maguire came off. Yeah. Luke Shaw was obviously injured as well. So that was unfortunate. That's why Wan-Bissaka went on. But that sums up Manchester United's squad, and that's not all Ten Hag's fault. Yes, the players. Martin's absolutely right. He's had too much influence on recruitment and the players he's highlighted and obviously said, you know, who's worked with in the past. Most of them haven't worked. But I watched this and thought they did well to stay in the game.
Yeah.
Like, Paul, you know, everything we're talking about Man United and what Wally was saying about the delusions of grandeur, Paul Hurst pointed out in his piece today, since Alex Ferguson retired, Bayern have played 25 Champions League knockout ties. Real Madrid have played 31, Barcelona 18, Man City 23, and United have played
six knockout ties
since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. So this should not be a shock or a surprise to
us. Their numbers are similar to like RB Leipzig and stuff like that. So that
Monaco, I think they were like Benfica were seven.
Yeah. Like, so that's the sort of that's
they're
the
a second, third tier European team now. And if people will listen to this and like be, I'm sure if you're a Man United fan, will be angry about that. But that's the fact. That's a fact. In the last decade, that's what Manchester United have become. And if you look at the team on the pitch and you look at the players that they put on to try and win a game that they were chasing in, you know, historic fashion that Manchester United should do at Old Trafford, you'll see why it didn't happen.
And there's so much desperation almost for them to be on the up again, for them to have, you know, this thing about turning the corner, they've turned the corner, turning so many corners, you end up back where you started. But like that Chelsea game last week, and everyone going, oh, Manchester United played really well. And when we were here last week, I said, I'm not sure they did. That's the worst Chelsea performance I've seen in about 20 years, Chelsea last week at Old Trafford. It was really poor. And it's not a case of not giving Manchester United credit. It was just a very poor performance by Chelsea, I thought. And I wasn't as encouraged, say, by that Man U performance to think, oh, right, this is it. They kick on from here. Because I thought the opposition was unnaturally weak, really, for Chelsea.
Yeah,
and there are problems there. There are real problems there with Manchester United because nothing is greatly consistent. They're always, even when they're winning, you can always, like the Everton game, which I thought was one of their better games, certainly the second half. But the first half, you know, Everton came flying back at them after the fabulous goal after 3 minutes. But what I remember about that game, and I hope I haven't misremembered it, but what I remember about that game is that Manchester United got the kick-off and they went there and then passed it back to Onana, who then launched it forward. And I'm thinking, this is Manchester United. This is not a team that, you know, I wasn't to be disrespectful. It's not Wimbledon in 90, you know, where there were, you know, that could be a plan. This is Manchester United. Like, whack, let's have that. And then after 3 minutes, the guy scored the greatest goal in 10 years, and so you forget about that.
Yeah.
But you look at it and you wonder what they are. Are they? Are they hitting it long? Are they knocking it about?
I don't think the way the game's played now doesn't suit Man United, because whenever I've took a team up there or played up there, you go out into the field and, you know, you're arse against the wind straight away.
Yeah.
The way
football's
played now, it's slow and methodical and build up. That doesn't suit what Man United should be about. You know, they would always get at you and non-stop coming at you for 90 minutes. Now you see the centre-backs, Harry Maguire to the other guy, back and forth. There's no real urgency. There's no bombardment of it. But that's the way football is at the moment. You know, that's again a cyclical thing. Whether that will change again, I don't know.
I'm interested in Wally's point about some of the signings and kind of, you know, I think you kind of said not slumming it, but kind of getting back to basics a little bit in terms of some of the signings as well. On the Times website at the minute, Paul Hurst and Konstantin Ekner writing about potential departures for Jadon Sancho, Rafa Varane, Casemiro, even the great Casemiro, who was the kind of big signing and brilliant.
Everyone could see that he was too old.
Yes, but this was my point. I was then going to say, do you then go, you're quite right, he's a good example
Sancho
of what I was
saying.
Sancho
was like 21, though. I mean, it's not restricted to age.
Everyone could see that he'd had an appalling year the year before in Germany.
No, I don't think that's fair. I think Sancho was a highly rated player, and he's just been sucked into the vortex that is Manchester United. Like, Bellingham, in that, though, he was £73 million. He's on £300,000 a week.
Yeah.
What are the chances of A, anyone paying that money, paying the salary that's not in Saudi Arabia, or B, them recouping even half of that in a transfer fee?
I don't think he had that great last year at Dortmund. I think there were a lot of clouds over him there. He didn't finish as well as Bellingham did, and there was issues with his timekeeping and turning up there. I think they paid vastly over it. And I think there was a red flag over him. Right away from then. Bellingham, no. Him, yes.
Yeah, but to then come on to the idea of, you know, something more proactive, who do they go for? If you think back to the summer, and Martin, you talked a lot about, you know, Declan Rice. Why would Manchester United not in for Declan Rice? Why were they not going for him? I would then drop down a couple of levels. Why Manchester United not in for James Ward-Prowse, say? to come to Wally's point about good pro, you know, experience.
Do you know why Arsenal turned it around 18 months ago or 2 years ago when he signed Ramsdale and the other? Is it White? The other guy?
Yeah, Ben White.
And he got rid of Aubameyang. And I saw the first or second game they played, Ramsdale made a save, White got the clearance away, and they both jumped up, fist bumped or chest bumped, whatever they did. And I thought, that's a completely different thing from what I've been seeing from
Arsenal. Players with character, then.
That's exactly what Man United don't have at the moment.
Yeah.
Martin. I mean, Harry Maguire has come through it a little bit, but I think he's burnt his bridges at United. I think he needs to move on. But they need to get some spine in that team, someone who's going to sort the dressing room out.
Yeah, well, you talk about Arsenal. That brings us nicely on to finishing the Champions League section on teams that did progress. Arsenal and Man City kind of cruising through, if you like. Do we think they are in the category of teams that we can consider winners? Manchester City obviously going through having won every game. Real Madrid did the same. Wally, are you kind of looking at the strength of those two teams and saying they should be looking semi-final at the least?
Well, I think, you know, City having won it can win it again. You know, the hardest thing, the albatross they had around their neck was having never won it. Mm. And I think they'll push on as far as they can. I think they've got a great chance of winning it. Arsenal, not so much. I think they can progress, but I think that they're more experienced than Newcastle, but right into that latter stages of it. I just think you're going to be found wanting a little bit there.
Martin?
Yeah, I can see that. It might not be England's year. We got very used to English teams winning it, English teams being in the final. You don't know, Bayern Munich look a good team to me. Real Madrid have qualified with a bullet yet again. And, you know, it cuts your chances down when you've only got two in there out of 16. You know, we're quite used to being a quarter of the round of 16, and now we're 1/8 of it. So that lessens your chances straight away. There's always the potential for the two English teams to draw each other in the quarterfinal. Then that cuts your chances again, and that's just percentages. I think they've both got the potential to win it, but I do think there are other teams in Europe this season that could give us some unfair money.
Gregor, final word from you on the Champions League going forward. I know you love a prediction. Go on.
I think Man City are the best team I've seen so far. I agree that Bayern and Real Madrid will be close. And then when you're talking about Arsenal, it'll depend on the draw. But they'll be in with a chance against anyone except those two. I think they'll still be with a chance with those two, but they're on another level, I think. But also, I think it's worth pointing out that's the end of the Champions League as we know it.
Yeah.
It's the last final year in the current format, and we're into the Swiss chessboard one.
Yeah, the Swiss thing. But then again, it is the system that is used to decide some of the great tournaments. Yu-Gi-Oh cards, for instance, uses the Swiss system. You know, I'm not sure about Pokemon, but I know Yu-Gi-Oh.
There you go. Well, listeners, if you've got any idea what Yu-Gi-Oh is, please do get in touch. tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. And also, if you've got any strong views on who...
Dragon Ball Z as well.
On who will win the Champions League, you can get in touch with me as well. That's the end of part one. In part two, we are going to be discussing the life and times of Wally Downs. Stick with us.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Gregor Robertson, and our special guest today, Wally Downs. Now, Wally, I wanted to talk about your playing career, but first, before any of your kind of achievements as a player, I was reading four leg breaks. in your career?
Yeah, well, I had a broken kneecap at 16. That was the first thing I had. And then I had four ankle breaks. I played 200 however many games, 250, I think, by the time I was 24, and 265 by the time I was 28.
Right.
So I had a break year back, four consecutive breaks.
And so is this, you know, part of a footballing era where tackles are a bit more loose and a bit more aggressive, should we say, yeah, or carelessness on your part? How are we getting all these leg breaks?
Forget the ball, get on with the game. there were more physical challenges, yeah, but I must have had some, well, I did say they had some weakness there in the bones, but they're fine now. I've got a couple of pins in them now and I had no problems at all with them.
Do you think it would have also been different in terms of your recovery and recuperation, that if you'd have been a player now, you might have had a longer playing career and recovered from those injuries in a different way?
Yeah, there was a sort of a general lax amount of work put in when you was out. If you was out for a sort of in a pot for 6 weeks, there was no real physio work done then. Right. It was like, as soon as you get your leg done, come back in. And so you didn't maintain a level of fitness that they do today, plus.
So you weren't kind of in the training ground even when you're back, you know, doing
physio. You might be told go in and do some weights at the ground on your own, but you know, the motivation to do that wears off after a while.
Yeah. No big one-on-one sessions with the physio, you know, getting it on the
Instagram. Yeah, in the sportsman pub next to the ground. <wasn't it? laughs>
Different times, should we say.
Yeah, Martin. They were.
So then your playing career with Wimbledon, the crazy gang. I was reading that potentially you being accused of being the chief instigator of the crazy gang. How would you respond to that?
Well,
accusation?
I was there from the get-go, so you know, that was probably the thing.
Is that a yes then?
Well, it is a yes, yeah. And it was the friend of Martin and I's, Tony Stenson, who was at the Mirror, and we'd had a couple of good cup runs, and they came down and did one of those pen picture things and asked me, and you know, and he said, we're just crazy guys, crazy gang.
Yeah.
And that was his big headline. And we beat Notts Forest a couple of nights later, European champions and all that at the time. So it stuck.
Yeah.
And because we were being successful at that period, you know, it was good coverage, easy coverage for the journalists, and easy for us just to reel it off all the time. And
easy for these lazy sods like Martin, basically, is what you're saying.
I would just like to say, if you were to hear any one of about 50 stories from that time, you would know why the crazy gang thing stuck, and I would invite Wally to tell any of them, but particularly the friendly against Leatherhead. That's the only one ever. That's the one I want to hear. The friendly against Leatherhead.
Well, this was my first game, so they were crazy before we went. I was still a schoolboy, and Bassett was running the reserves then, and they used to like to play him. So he was a midfield player in the first team, but he liked to play centre back and get the ball out from the back and play and pass on that. So it's my first game. Dickie Guy's in goal, and it's a decent team. We're only playing Leatherhead because Harry hated a fella called Chris Kelly, who Leatherhead had a couple of great runs in the cup, and he went up doing predictions, and he was called Kelly the Lip, or Chris the Lip, Kelly the Leatherhead Lip. That's right, yeah. Now, Bassett and his team had won the Southern League a couple of years on the trot, and they looked down and was like, winners but no consistency, and hated the fact that he was getting all the credit. So we play Leatherhead. First half is a corner, and as it comes over, I shout out keepers, expecting Dickie Guy to come for it. So he hasn't, and they've headed it. It's gone over, wasn't a goal, but he's got hold of me at half time and said, there's only one person who calls keeper here, and it's me, not you. It's like he didn't even know who I was.
Yeah.
And we go out the second half, Bassett gets the ball off of Dick, beats one player, and it's in our own box. Fella comes in, he's just overplayed. It's a block tackle. Another one comes in, he's slid into him now, and there's a clash of heads as they come out. And he's not even out the 18-yard box now, and he's trying to come out expensive football. As he gets out of the box, he tried to hit a 60-yard diagonal left to the right wing. But this Kelly has chased him down. He's hit Kelly, gone smashing towards Dick's goal. Just missed. Dick's turned around to get the ball. We've all come back. It's going to be a goal kick again. But Dick hasn't come back from behind the goal. One of the fans has got the ball. Dick's wrestling with the guy to get the ball off of him. And now the fans are coming down, and there's a little bit of Dick's right in the middle. So I've gone round to help Dick and get the ball off of him and whatever. And have a couple of players getting involved. And I'm looking through the gap where Dick and this guy are to and frying with the ball. And there's this fella running. He's jumped over and he's running towards Dick. So I think
one of the fans.
One of the fans, yeah. So I finished my little tussle here, and as this comes through, Dick, I've gone round, clocked this guy as he's coming through, knocked his glasses off, knocked him over, and turned back to Dick, who's looked at me. I couldn't believe the anger in his face. What are you doing? Said, what do you mean? I said, the bloke was coming to... He said, that's my brother-in-law. He was coming to help me. So, so from the first... This is my first game. First half, I've called keepers away. And he's got me by the throat at half-time. And the second half, I've clocked his brother-in-law. So it wasn't most...
that's your debut.
That was my debut.
And how old were you?
I was 15 then.
15?
Yeah. So I came into a crazy team, to be fair.
Blimey. I mean, this is quite the departure. I'm just reflecting on us having these big discussions around Champions League football.
What he said afterwards in the dressing room was, if ever you hit one of my family again, I said, Dick, as if I'm going to find any of your family and start hitting them. I said, it's not going to happen. I didn't know he was. Well, I'm just telling you.
But it didn't get you out of the team, though, you know, because for a lot of people, 15 clocking...
Maybe catch him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, that's it. No. Well, if you're looking around, this is all going on. Bassett and Kelly are now rolling around on the floor having a wrestle in the 18-yard
Any idea what the score finished, that one?
I can't remember. 4-2, I think, to someone.
Yeah.
Dick let a fair few in that day after he got ruffled. He used to get ruffled a bit, Dick, so...
Yeah. And then, so in terms of your playing career from then, do you play as a midfielder, is that right?
Well... To be fair, I played everywhere. I started in midfield. Bassett decided to go with a sweeper system after he went to the World Cup in 82, came back, put me sweeper, went 12 games unbeaten, top of the league, lost at Bristol City, and he changed it and said, no, we're going direct now. So then I went to right wing, because all he wanted was crosses, non-stop crosses and set pieces. So he had me on the right wing, Glyn Hodges on the left. Zero pace, but we were good at delivering the ball. In fact, that Wimbledon team, for 5 years there, we held the record of disciplinary points. We beat ourselves every year. And it was the two wingers, a centre forward in three of those years. So it weren't a defender's kicking, it was where we were... Very aggressive, say as an attacking side.
Yeah. And that obviously was part of the kind of the folklore, if you like, around that Wimbledon team. But was it as nakedly obvious as that? You know, in terms of getting stuck into the opposition, was that part of the team talks each game? Was that part?
No.
Or was it just you were just a physical team, and it was a slightly different era of football?
Well, you had to be physical, because if you look at the divisions that we were coming through, the fourth and the third division. You know, you go to Rochdale and places like that on a Tuesday night, you've got to be physical. And, not many teams from down south had done well in the fourth division and the third division. You know, not many got promoted because of the difficulty of, there may be us, Torquay, top of me, I can't think, in Northampton. The rest, you're going right the way up north. So you had to be able to look after yourself. Plus, we were hard running and aggressive. That's what it was. You know, we were.
So you were fit physically.
Very
fit. As well.
Yeah, very fit. Yeah. If we used to piss him off in training, it was like, go on, 3 mile run, and we'd run down Wimbledon Common for free.
Well, I was going to say, you were talking about the kind of rehab from your injuries in terms of the training, not particularly sophisticated, would we say, in terms of the getting to that fitness.
Not particularly sophisticated, because it was just shuttle runs and long distance runs into that. But we'd get sent for a 3 mile. Run if he thought we weren't performing well enough in training, and we'd always finish with 10 shuttle runs at the end every day.
Yeah.
So the level of fitness was high, and we were made to play that way, and teams struggled to keep up with us, to be fair.
Yeah. Gregor, how do you reflect on hearing some of those stories from having had a career in the Football League yourself, in terms of some of the things Wally said about playing in teams up north, you know, and also some of the fitness regimes that perhaps you'd have gone through?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing about the whole story is something that will never really happen again, will it? The Wimbledon story.
No, impossible. I mean, everyone, when they talk about the Wimbledon story from going from the fourth to the first, but it wasn't all beer and skittles. It was like, if you look at the sequence, it was, and these are the divisions, the numbers. When we came into the league, 4-4, 3-4-3, 4-3-2-2-1. So it was 10 years to get there. But the last jump was done But there was a lot of heartache and there was a lot of relegation. Yeah.
Yeah. Either got promoted or relegated for about four seasons. Yeah,
it wasn't necessarily the kind of Luton.
We were kids and we got relegated with Dario and then Harry came in and put all his faith in the youngsters. But again, it wasn't enough and we got relegated. But he stuck with us and the club stuck with him. And that basis sort of, by the time we got into the second division, I suppose, the championship as it's now, you know, we had a lot of kids, 21, 22, played 150 games, at various levels. So we knew our job and we'd been well coached. And, we was more than capable and prepared to go into the championship and the Premier League. We'd beaten Notts Forest, we played Everton, you know, we'd showed we could turn it on when we had to. So we were coming.
Yeah. The other thing is, like, when you said that, it was almost like a throwaway comment that we're a crazy gang. Did that grow arms and legs? Is it something you eventually you kind of all together you thrived on and everyone had to become a part of?
Yeah, if we hadn't have been successful as we was, we know we'd have drifted away. But because we kept getting promoted, because we kept having cup runs, it was great coverage for the journalists and for us, and we played on it more and more.
Yeah, Martin, what do you remember from covering that team?
No, don't, because he was
no, but what I remember
I'm
is,
sure it'll be very complimentary, Rod.
That became like the stamp.
Yeah.
Because when Bobby Gould takes over, for instance, Bobby's got a, you know, set of boxing gloves over his desk, hasn't he, and all that sort of stuff. Bobby's got a set of boxing gloves over his desk. You know, if anyone wants to have a disagreement, we'll put the gloves on and we'll sort it out. I doubt very much if Bobby Gould would have done that at any club he'd ever been at before. But because it was Wimbledon, it sort of fitted the mentality. And I'm not sure how many times they were used. I think they might have been used against Carlton Fairweather once, if at all.
Who could be bothered to go and get the gloves?
No.
wouldn't have lasted in Harry's day.
No, that's right. And so, but that became the stamp. That became the stamp of the club. But what is also overlooked, it, you know, from that era, if you look at the players that they had as well coming through and the players that were sold on, they had good players. Mm. They had very good players. Nigel Winterburn comes out of Wimbledon. Dennis Wise comes out of Wimbledon. There's very, very good players in there as well.
Who was the best that you played with at Wimbledon, did you say?
Well, I think going on achievements probably have to be Wisey or the goalie, Besson. Mm. He's very underrated, Besson. You know, he was I think Shilton and Clements was around at his time, but he was, you know, he was very, very good. Just going on from that, we had, I think it was 11 players that had played in all four divisions by the time we got to the Premier League, and there was 13 that had come through the academy that played in the Premier League as well. So, you know, everything was bought through there. Was, as he says, he picked up Nigel for nothing, Dennis for nothing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was an amazing achievement. It won't happen again because players would get picked off now and taken from you. Whereas then, you know, Harry was very quick to tell us that we were useless and we wouldn't get anywhere else with any other clubs. And nobody ever sort of thought that any of our players could adapt and come out. But they could. Well, they didn't realise is we were good players playing in a system that nobody liked.
Yeah. So when you talk about it, that's an interesting point, nobody liked. When you then came up against the bigger teams, you know, any fond memories of playing some of those bigger teams?
It's wonderful to play against the Liverpools and Man Uniteds because Brucey and Pallister didn't like the ball being turned around and fast chasing after them. Yeah. You know, it was an anathema to how they would, they'd been dictating the league. You know, Liverpool knocking it about and no one put it in behind them. And that's all we did. And you could see they didn't like doing it. Anson and Lawrenson and people like that running towards their own goal. Ratcliffe people, they weren't used to it and didn't do it.
When you were playing those teams, you know, it's something that some pundits now talk about, Roy Keane in particular, when, you know, players these days, a bit maybe too much respect between opposition players. When you're playing in those, are you kind of in the dressing room beforehand going, let's go and give these guys a game?
Well, that sort of thing we said, but there was, if we'd have been stupid to go out and treat them with respect, we'd have got our asses kicked. Mm. We had to go out there and show them no respect and play the way we played. If we'd have got caught up in respecting Alan Hansen or Dalgleish or any of them, you know, you'd have had no chance because you'd have tried to occupy the same area that they were in, and we couldn't do that. We had to play our own way. When you think about it, I don't remember playing a single game for Wimbledon where we weren't the lowest paid, smallest budget for the whole squad, least supported, You know, we should have never, ever won a game. Even in the fourth division, going to Rochdale and places like that, we had the lowest budget.
And that was always the mentality in terms of it. And that obviously helped, right?
Yeah, but we didn't look upon ourselves as underdogs. But that's me just reflecting. Right. A couple of years ago, I thought, every game I ever played, we was always the lowest budget. So progressing through the leagues, that became more obvious. But we started off in the fourth division at the lowest. And so we were used to never going out and getting cocky, never going out and thinking we were better than we were. You know, we knew we had to be bang on our game and all playing for one another every single time we played. And that was a bonus.
And that sort of playing to their strengths as well. I'll start telling this story and Wally can take it over. But Alan Cork and the lack of service that he claimed to be getting. This is what I mean about playing to their strengths. So who were you playing when?
I can't remember who was playing. He started doing it all the time. We came in at half time. Bassett's going nuts, and me and Glyn Hodges used to sit next to each other in the corner, both the wingers.
Yeah.
And Corky was a terrific goal scorer, but he couldn't play football. He was useless. It'd come off one day. Harry, it's not my fault they keep passing the ball to my feet. Where'd you go with that? So we've come in at half time, and if we weren't doing very well, Hodge would just get the programme out and start reading it. Bassett would be ranting and he'd look over.
And he'd be reading the programme. You
know, I'll be sitting next to him and I go, Hodge, put the fucking programme away, will you? And he'd be going, Hodge, put a programme down. And then he'd talk, Nigel, you're not getting the ball forward. Hodge, put the programme down. And he went, Hodge would never do it. Corky, what are you doing? Put your boots back on, Harry, I'm not going out in the second half. Porky, put your boots back on. No, I'm not going out in the second half. Why not? Because them two won't cross the ball to me, Harry. And if they don't cross the ball to me, I can't edit. And if I can't edit, I'm no good. You know I'm no good. Corky, put your boots. No, I'm not putting them on. Wally, Hodges, start crossing the ball to Corky, will you? So we go out second half, put a couple of crosses in. Corky scores a goal. In we come. As we're walking off, he says, you know, I'll be taking these boots off every day, every half time. But, you know, we knew as much about our game. Like, Harry taught us really well how to play against it. And Corky was just making a point in the best way that he could. But a very strong dressing room and a very irreverent dressing room as well.
Yeah. Gregor, you reckon you'd have ever gotten away with reading the programme at half-time if you'd been losing?
Purposely reading the programme. Yes. No interest in it either.
God, no. I just dread to think what a reaction a manager would be, though. But it's incredible because, like, I played against Wimbledon at the very start of my career, just before the real trouble started. And I've even spoken to people like Joby McEnough, who, like, this is a different generation, but he came through as a youth team player there.
Yeah.
And the identity of the club was kind of, had continued all that time. And he was saying that he came through in a similar sort of, you know, ruthless environment as an academy player. And that's, what, I don't know, that's like 20,
it was different after Bassett left and a few of us left. And it was taken on more when they went to sort of Selhurst, and it was more of a caricature of it. You know,
okay.
They played up to a lot more Vinny, Fash. They'd stayed there and people coming in. They really played up to the crazy gang thing there.
Okay.
Whereas really, it had happened in those 4-4-3-2-3, all those years. That's where that all started, and it was picked up. When I left, you know, when Vinny came, Harry said to me, we've got this kid coming in from non-league. Physio's told me, he said, I know him. He said, well, physio's told me he's a bit lively, so look after him, will you, and he'll be rooming with you. Fucking bit lively. So I had to look to try and see him through for the next 18 months. But then when I went, he picked it up and really carried it.
So how old would Vinnie Jones have been when you were shepherding him through his young days?
21, 22,
right?
Might have been a bit younger.
And when you say a bit lively, anything that you could mention on a podcast or? That was a pregnant silence.
he made his debut against Forest, and he's caught the ball and give a penalty away at half time. So when he's come in, we used to have a kit man called Sid, old Sid Neil, and he's walked in and he don't know what to do, he don't know what to say. And so Harry's going round the room and he ain't said nothing to Vinny about it. So Vinny said to Sid, how do you think I'm doing? He said, I don't think you'll be needing that shirt next week. So.
Even the kit man's putting you down. Everyone's in on it. Everyone's in on it. Absolutely ruthless is the right word, Gregor. I mean, absolutely fascinating. I'm sure we could listen to stories from the Crazy Gang all day. But I wanted to ask you about your coaching career as well, because coming back to those broken legs, they ultimately meant that you had to retire from playing. Is that right?
And then you public went, demand, really.
You then went into coaching, did your coaching badges. And as I said, you coached lots of places. Crystal Palace, Brentford, Reading, Southampton, Gillingham, West Ham. Which of those times, which was your favourite as a starting question? Which did you enjoy the most as a coach?
I'd have to say Reading was the most successful. Mm. So obviously that's enjoyable while it's going. But as a Londoner and as a coach and a member of staff, working at West Ham was sort of the best I feel that I could have achieved. Because if you look at the ownership and the management at the clubs, various clubs there, like Wenger had his people, and everybody who came in, Mourinho, these Portuguese guys, and you look at, because West Ham had English, you know, that was just, I'm looking at it thinking, well, this is the best chance you're going to get. So I really enjoyed my time at West Ham.
Was that with Sam Allardyce?
Yeah, we got promoted, and the pressure was on there, because, you know, it's getting Sam in and maintaining some of the players and not having a fire sale, and then bringing players in like Kevin Nolan and stuff. Mm. It was like a guerrilla attack on the first on the Premiership. You know, if we'd have been out the top six at any time, you'd have had people in the stands
shouting at you.
so we, you know, that's one of the times when you knew you had to do it. Reading was a different thing. You know, Reading was I'd probably say Steve Copper was at his best there as a manager. I think that was my best time as a coach. I'm sort of 42, 3, 4, still joining a little bit, so I can relate to the players. And it was like a perfect storm. Mm. You know, everybody, we got the right kids there, and that team we had there was very, very good.
Do you think your points record's under threat this season?
No.
Still the points record, isn't it?
Still the record.
It was for a brief spell that Burnley might attack it last season, but they fell away. That's the thing, teams always, they fall away, but you guys kept going right to the end.
Yeah, we did. Well, I think we'd won it with 12 games. Well, we'd got promoted with 12 games to go.
Yeah.
Which was difficult then to keep them going. I mean, we had two end of season trips before the season finished. You know, we went to took them to Marbella for 3 or 4 days but just kept winning, you know. They were more motivated. It's difficult to keep motivating them when you got promoted with that far to go. So you say, right, we've got to go on and win it.
Yeah.
But the players were hungry enough to want to do that anyway. We didn't really need to be into them all the time. They could see they could get 100 points. They could see they could get 100 goals. And you know, the motivation of the team, of the players, if the players are motivated, then your job's easy.
I only ask that because Leicester and Ipswich have both accumulated a record points tally at this stage of the season.
To this stage, haven't
you? Yeah, so it's possible, but you have to maintain it. So.
Long way to go. What type of coach were you, are you? You know, you talked about working with Koppel, working with Allardyce. I imagine potentially quite different managers. Do you have to kind of dovetail to the manager you're working with as an assistant?
Yeah, that's the important thing. You know, with Steve liked to take a back seat, so I was very vocal. Steve would spend hours... this was before analysis has got to where it is today, and he'd have sort of three videos at his house, taping one game to another and putting it into cutting it up. And he'd be at home Saturday night, all through the weekend, looking at our opponents. He might come in and say to me at staff meeting on Monday, they do this, they do that, I'm worried about this. So just sort the week out around that.
Right.
And he'd be on the sideline. So I'd have a free run at that, you know, as long as he wanted something tweaked, he'd say, look, that wasn't what I meant after the training on Tuesday. Just tweak it again. So he gave me free rein. Whereas Sam was more, he didn't really worry about things till Thursday, Sam. You know, he'd come in and he'd just let us get on with the training, nothing real specific. But, you know, he'd come out and put his detail in on Thursday and Friday. So, again, that was a bit of babysitting as well. But I mean, Bassett was I'd have to say that, very underrated, Harry, because he got, like Sam says, he gets pigeonholed, but Harry got pigeonholed as well. You know, he had a guy called Vince Craven, who was one of Don Howe's big mates, cutting videos up for us in 1982. Opposition stuff, we're looking at Inter Milan and things like that. You know, very, very sports psychologist Harry had in very early. He was very open and receptive to new things, Harry.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. You've led me onto it perfectly. How do you look at, you know, modern coaching, the kind of slight fascination with tactics that we have now, perhaps more within the media than we did before? Are you one of those people that kind of sits and perhaps sounds like, oh, this has been happening the whole time, it's just got different names for it now?
That is a big thing. There's lots of different names for things now. You know, it's transitions. You know, Harry used to call it pressurising, now it's pressing. Mm. I mean, I went to the Tottenham game the other night and they took, you know, the inverted fullback thing where they sort of clog up the midfield and let the two centre-backs have it out wide, which is great, but they're 2-1 down against West Ham with 10 minutes to go and their left-back is inside what would be the old inside left position. I don't suppose you even remember that.
Yeah, the number, I've heard of it.
Yeah, it'd be like, he's 10 yards outside the box in a central position. I'm thinking, everyone's there. What, you know? Why are you in there? What are you going to do when you get it? He's hardly a nippy little inside forward. He's a 6'3" left back.
Yeah,
should be out wide, getting around the outside of people and getting crosses in. I think that's going back to the United thing. The amount of crosses United used to get him, there's Lee Sharp and Beckham on one side getting down the outside. Beckham wouldn't get down the outside, but he crossed the ball in. The others, the Kanchelskis getting around people and getting crosses. And United don't do that now. Mm. They cross and pass back to the fullback coming on. Easiest way to defend is a cross coming from in front of you. There's nobody getting behind people for Man United. They're trying to make their own goals and trying to create for themselves. That poor sod down the middle, I don't imagine how many chances he's ever going to get.
Yeah. You also went and worked in India. What was that like in terms of the footballing culture?
Well, it was eye-opening because they tried 4 sports to try and fill their slot because the cricket's non-stop over there. Yeah. But when the cricket isn't on, they tried to fill it with, I think, like kabaddi 1 year, hockey another year, and they finally got round to football. And, you know, they got to Hollywood stars to own teams, and Bollywood stars, sorry, to own teams. And they had to bring in foreign players. So there was 5 or 6, I think it was 5 was the quota you could have. So there were a lot of sort of, Maluda was out there, a lot of South Americans and a few Spanish, alongside 6 Indian players. So it was different because the Indian, brought up on vegetarian diets, and they're very frail and wiry and strong. But you saw that progress as they saw gym work and different foods and all that. So initially, it was whoever had the best 5 foreign players and hide the Indians wherever where they could do the least damage. Yeah. But that is now progressing, and the Indian players are getting much better.
Yeah,
lots of money thrown at it, and very professional, but there was a contrast, you know, in the style of the players.
I guess it's always going to be secondary to cricket in that country. I could keep talking for ages and ages, but I want to finish by asking you just generally about football now. You know, you touched on you talked about watching Tottenham. What teams, what coaches, having coached a lot yourself, what teams do you watch currently, whether it's in the Premier League or other leagues around the world, that you really get excited by or you admire? Managers, coaches, ways of playing?
Well, I like the way that Guardiola's so flexible. I mean, he was talking last year to Martin. Was that in the cup final when they scored that goal?
Yes, where they went long.
Yeah, they went long to Haaland, knocked it down. And it's exactly what Bassett was saying to us 30, 40 years ago. Mm. Besson would ping it up to Corky or Stuart Evans. Ball would drop down. 2 people coming onto it, get it wide or get a shot in as quick as you can. And that's how they scored after 2 minutes in the cup final. So the fact that he is not a football snob, Guardiola, don't like the way the game is with the centre-backs getting the ball in their own box and playing. Now, I went to Tottenham West Ham last week. The two Tottenham centre-backs and the goalkeeper were keeping the ball. The 3 West Ham strikers were 15 yards off them, and they must have had 25. That's not exciting to me. There was nothing in that. You know, I cannot for the life of me see how fans can enjoy going and watching that. You know, football's about getting the ball forward, getting the ball into goal-scoring areas. If you could play some intricate play in the opposition's half, fantastic, and there's a purpose to it. But it's not what I was brought up on as a football fan. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's goal mouth incidents, random incidents, blood and guts. And
yeah, hopefully don't punch your goalkeeper's brother-in-law.
Well, he's kept clear of me since. So
There you go, and probably wise to do so. Wally Dance, thank you very much for joining us on the Game podcast. Martin Samuel and Gregor Robson, thank you for joining me too. We'll be back on Monday with best reaction to the latest weekend's action. Wally, thank you very much for joining us again. Thanks for listening.